Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is Chuck Huff, and he will be speaking on prejudice. Some of my best friends are... So, let's listen in on Chuck.
All this week has been talking about social perception. That is, about how we think about each other and how those thoughts are influenced by our preconceptions. For those of you on the tape, that's not me, that's somebody hammering across the street. What I hope to do, some of you have heard this spiel five times before, but you can deal with it. What I hope to do is to help you to think a little bit more complexly about these issues. There are many sort of popular psychologists who write books and show up on national public television who will give you a personality test and say that you are an NPQRTSZY and that tells you exactly how you should act from here on out. Some of those tests are very useful, but they really don't provide you with answers. So the people who act like they provide you with answers, I think, are misleading you. If I'm successful, I hope that, in fact, what I will have done by the end of this series is confused you a little bit more about how easy it is to make conclusions about other people. And made you a little bit more careful and cautious as you make conclusions about what other people are like. So, having done the general introduction, what we're supposed to talk about today is the general topic of prejudice with the subtitle of Some of My Best Friends Are. This is a standard rhyme that we often hear from people who want to exclaim that they are not prejudiced because some of their best friends are women, blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, whatever. Even white males sometimes get in there. So, what I need to do real quickly is to go back over some of the territory that we covered this week in order for us to understand why really it's inadequate and dangerous and even misleading to say some of my best friends are as a defense against the claim that you might be prejudiced. First, those of you who have heard me talk before know that we've talked a lot about this bit of psychojargon called schemas. Schemas are just a word that keeps us from being grandiose when we talk about theories that we have about other people and how other people work. They are filters through which we see the world. And these filters are very automatic, and they work very fast and efficiently. They work so fast and efficiently that we are convinced of what comes through the filter as the truth, as though it were not filtered. Did that make sense? It actually is filtered, but somehow it feels to us like it's not filtered. Those of you who have some question about that can ask someone who's come to some of the earlier sessions to tell you a story about saliva. But I won't do it today. I've done it 2 days in a row. It's been kind of fun, actually. So we believe that what we're really seeing is the truth, when in fact what we're seeing is a version of the truth, or a filtered version of what happens. So that's what schemas do. Now, one of the important things that social psychologists in the last 10 years and the research that they've done have found out about schemas, and this is crucial really to our understanding, is that schemas don't work at the level that our justice dialogue usually occurs on. Our justice dialogue usually occurs on the level of don't be prejudiced against women, or don't be prejudiced against blacks, or don't be prejudiced against people with long hair, please. In fact, if you look at the research, you find that the kinds of schemas that we use that give us information about other people, that allow us to make quick assumptions about other people, don't work on the level of all women. So if I were to say, you know, this person is a woman, what can you tell me about her? You would be very reluctant to tell me anything. Or if I said, this person is an African American, what can you tell me about her? You would be very reluctant to say anything. It's at a lower level that we really keep a lot of the information in our schemas. So you may not be willing to conclude very much if I tell you that someone is a woman. But my bet is that a whole lot more associations will come up in your mind when I tell you that a particular person is a radical feminist woman. All right? And all kind of things pop up in your mind and say, oh, I know what radical feminist women are like. It's useful to have these schemas, and we have to have them. We use them all the time. They're useful in our lives. But we need to know how they work. And since they work at this level, this sub-level of kinds of women, for with blacks, for instance, a lot of the research has shown that most of the middle-class white population thinks of two kinds of blacks. They think of middle-class blacks, and they think of streetwise blacks. And if I say to you, someone is a black person, you are unlikely to be willing to make very many inferences. But if I say they are middle-class black, some more inferences come out. So the place where the schemas work is at this sub-level, rather than at the level that we have a lot of our dialogue about justice. Now, what does that mean for the phrase, some of my best friends are? Well, it means that certainly some of your best friends might be blacks, they're just not the kind of blacks that you're prejudiced against. They fit into the part that works fine for you, and this allows you to have your cake and to eat it too. It allows me to do it too. I don't want to just blame you. Because some of our best friends are in a particular category, we are able to reply to the person who says, don't be prejudiced. We can say, oh, well, here's an example of blacks. I'm fine with that. Here's an example of women, but she doesn't bother me at all. I think she's perfectly capable. So it allows us to be able to say, sit in church when people say you should care about justice issues and say, oh, I do, when in fact our prejudice lives at a level that the church has yet to address. Just because we're used to talking about justice issues in terms of these larger categories. So that's one reason why this phrase, some of my best friends are, can be misleading. It looks like you're not being prejudiced, but in fact, that's not the level that your prejudice lives at. It lives at another level. Another way to use schemas to talk about prejudice is to for a minute, talk about them as though they were theories. That is, when we think about science, we think about theories that people have And they take the theories and they put them up against the evidence, and they see if the evidence connects and confirms or disconfirms the theory. We do this with our schemas. We have particular theories about, or schemas about people of a particular category. And when we interact with somebody, we get evidence, right? We get data about the kind of person that they are. Well, some of the research has shown that if we get disconfirming evidence, we often don't use it to discount our schema. That is, we often don't use it to say, oops, I might have been wrong. What we often do is use a strategy called subsetting. And now we're back to this whole issue of the level at which our prejudices live. We say, in general, blacks are untrustworthy, but this one is okay. Or women in general aren't competent in science, but she is a little different. And I'll let her be in my lab. This subsetting strategy allows us to both maintain our theories or schemas about a particular group and to deal with this disconfirming evidence that we get. Now, I don't want to claim that subsetting like this is always a bad thing. In fact, we're often very busy people. We don't have very much time to be revising our theories all the time. So it's sometimes useful to subset. And maybe it is that this one person is just a little bit different from that category. But the problem is when you do that two or three or four times, now you got 8 little subsets. And you still haven't changed your theory about what these, quote, people are like. So here's another way we can have our cake and eat it too. Some of our best friends can be members of this subset of women who are competent, but we can still maintain our theory, our schema, that women in general are not competent in business or in science. Now, another problem, and this is less based in the kind of schema things we've been talking about all week, but it does connect with some of the things we've talked about with the power of the situation. Another problem is that our prejudice often does not show up except in very rare circumstances. That is, we will not act prejudiced when it looks like we might get caught. Let me give you an example of, I think, one of the slickest studies I have heard in many years that was done with thinking about people's understandings of handicapped folks. In this particular instance, people in wheelchairs. They set this study up at a Midwestern university in a lounge that was about the size of the room here, the fireside room. A student lounge, and the student lounge had 2 televisions with sets of chairs sitting in front of each of the 2 televisions, right? One television over here with a bunch of chairs at it, and another television over here with a bunch of chairs at it. And they brought people in to be in a study. And they said, well, we're not quite ready with the study. We haven't got all the stuff set up with the study. So what we'd like you to do is just go over in that room and sit down. There's a couple televisions in there. You can see watch what you like, do what you like, and we'll come get you in about 15 minutes. Well, if you know anything about social psychology studies, of course we were being sneaky. What we did, this isn't a study I was involved in; it's some colleagues. I'm sneaky in other studies. What they did is they had a person in a wheelchair in there that they paid, you know, it was an actor, to sit in a wheelchair and watch television. That's a nice job. And that person would sit at one television or the other, and of course they balanced whether it was on the left or the right and all these sorts of things we do. And what they wanted to do was to see if the person would sit in the group of chairs where the handicapped person was sitting, where the person in the wheelchair was, or if they'd go across the room and sit over in front of the other television set. Does this setup make sense? You want to see if they're willing to sit next to this generally stigmatized person, someone in a wheelchair. Well, here's what I thought was the really cool part. They either had the same television program on both TVs, or they had a different program on. Now, if they had the same television program on, and you come into the room and there's a person in a wheelchair there, and you go to the other side of the room to watch the same television program, it's clear what you're thinking. I don't want to sit next to them. But if you come in and the other television has a different program on it, and of course they counterbalanced which program there was and all that stuff, but if the other television has a different program on it, you can say, oh, I am much more interested in ferrets than I am in the nightly news. And you can go over and watch that television program about ferrets. And in fact, this is what they found, is that when the programs were different, the vast majority of people preferred not to sit near the person in the wheelchair. But when the programs were the same, the vast majority of people sat down close to the person in the wheelchair. So the situation often constrains our behavior and makes it difficult for us to act out our prejudices. And again, what happens here in terms of our prejudiced thoughts, now think about this. This person can go to the other side of the room, act out their prejudice against someone in a wheelchair. And they don't even have to tell themselves that they've done it. Much less the person in the wheelchair. So you don't even get this tension where you say, oh, I'd like to be prejudiced, to yourself and say, ooh, what kind of person am I? I don't like to be a prejudiced person. But in those situations where we can act out our prejudice without, quote, getting caught, we often do. And that means that we don't even get information about our own prejudices. And I would not be surprised if the situations in which some of your best friends are situations where it's hard for you to avoid them. Yeah, work with them. So, we've got a whole variety of ways of avoiding, really, our prejudice while still maintaining it. We've got a whole raft of ways of having our cake and eating it too. Now, one common answer, and I want to spend some time on this one because it's the standard one people think about as a, quote, fix for prejudice. One common answer to issues of prejudice is to say, well, let's just get folks together. All right? We have surprised some psycho jargon for this. We call this the contact hypothesis. Right? The contact hypothesis is if you put two different kinds of people who have stereotypes about each other into contact with each other, they'll find out that they have a lot in common and their prejudices will go away. Simply put, it's wrong. It doesn't work. Simple contact does not work to reduce prejudice. And this is why I have the overhead. And you can see this print is a little larger. There are a whole raft of conditions that you have to meet in order to get intergroup contact to reduce prejudice. Because now remember, we're working against all of these other biases that we've just been talking about, right? The ability to subset and say, oh, well, you know, this one is a little different from all the rest of them. The fact that our prejudices are maintained at a level that doesn't work with our dialogue about prejudice. We maintain our prejudices at lower levels, like feminist instead of woman. And the fact that we often are not in situations that we overtly show our prejudice, but we only show our prejudice when we're in a situation where we won't get caught. And in fact, where we won't even catch ourselves. One of the things that has to happen to get prejudice to be reduced with intergroup contact is that the groups have to have shared goals. The two different groups that you're trying to get to talk to each other, this is the kind of list that's very useful to take back to churches that are split down the middle. Or to take to organizations that are split like this. But it also works with the standard kinds of justice dialogue that we have about minorities in our society and women. You need to have shared goals, because if you don't have shared goals, it's possible for the two of you to get together and just fight, after all, right? The task that you have to involve cooperation and independence, interdependence. I'm going to give you an example of why that might not, of why just having shared goals might not work. When I'm from the South, if you can't tell, when my daddy would have work to do for the city in Florida, it was the city of Lutz, Florida, L-U-T-Z, who would often do things for them. Very often, blacks and whites would come together in order to do some kind of construction work. City didn't have a whole lot of money. We did a lot of the laying of the sidewalks and stuff ourselves instead of contracting it out. But what you would find is that the blacks would take all of the menial labor roles, and the whites would take all of the supervisory roles and the skilled work roles. Now, there's a little bit of cooperation, because if the blacks don't put the brick up on the scaffold, the whites can't lay it. But there's still a considerable amount of independence among those two different groups and the tasks that they have to do. And that allows them then to think, well, we do X and X is better than this other, and never change their opinions about each other. So not only do you need to have shared goals, but the tasks that you use to accomplish those goals need to involve cooperation and interdependence. The contact between the groups has to be informal enough so that people actually talk to each other, so that one-on-one interaction happens enough. Again, let's think of this issue of the blacks in Lutz, Florida. If what they're doing is the sort of labor jobs, and the whites are doing the skilled jobs, they don't talk to each other very much. And in fact, we would rarely sit with each other during lunch break. We were working on the same sidewalk, but we did not sit with each other during lunch break. We had a shared dole. We had maybe some cooperation and interdependence, but we didn't have any one-on-one interaction with each other. So we didn't really get to know each other as people. We only got to know each other as skilled laborers or unskilled ones. The contact has to occur in a setting where folks are interested about things like group equality and increased association between the groups. Because even if you have the other three, it's still possible if everybody thinks it's a bad thing to talk to each other for this not to work. There needs to be some social influence or social pressure to suggest to people that the right thing to do is to talk to each other. Again, another way you can think of these lists is ways intergroup contact can fail to reduce prejudice. It can fail if there aren't some kind of norms that are influencing everybody to want to treat each other equally. The interaction has to encourage or at least permit some kind of disconfirming evidence of the stereotype to appear. Let's go back to our construction example again. If the blacks are always doing the menial labor and they are never put in supervisory positions, well, you never get any evidence that they might be able to do it. So that your schema, your hypothesis about them as not being very bright, is never falsified. You never get any false evidence. And finally, this last one is really important, partly because of this subsetting thing that we talked about before. If I think that the person is typical or representative of the group, then it's hard for me to subset them. Right? If the female scientist in my lab is sort of the typical female, it's hard for me to say then, she's just different, but all the rest of the women could never do science. Now, you can achieve this last goal in a whole raft of different ways. It doesn't have to be that the one person has to be typical. Well, who knows what the typical female is? It might be that you achieve this last goal by having people who are vastly different within the group. So if you want to reduce people's prejudice about blacks, you can't just have middle class blacks as the folks that you interact with. It has to be blacks from various socioeconomic statuses and who have various kinds of jobs and have various kinds of abilities and skills, so that sooner or later, we're all going to subset when we have this problem, right? We're all going to say, oh, well, he's different. But sooner or later, that subsetting is going to break down. You're going to have 37 subsets for the 37 people that you know, and you're going to begin to say, well, gosh, something's wrong here. So in order to get the contact hypothesis, in order to get intergroup contact to reduce prejudice, you need to have all of these things working together in concert. Because if you don't, there's always a way out. This suggests that it's going to be a much harder job to reduce prejudice than simply to schlep people onto buses and send them to the same high school. By the way, it is true, been reduced in the South. Racial prejudice has been reduced in the South by school integration programs that has had an effect. But part of the reason it's had an effect is some of these other things have happened. They've all been on the same teams. They've all been in the same classes. They've had to do homework together. There's been lots of them instead of just one or two. So it's worked not simply because of contact, but because a lot of these things were there. But simply putting people in different groups together and expecting them to reduce their prejudice is not going to work. In fact, it might even backfire. Let me give you one example of how it can backfire. When I was a little boy, I don't know, maybe about this tall, my mama took me to the Bahamas, and we lived in Florida. This is not a big deal, right? But she took me off to the Bahamas. And the only thing I remember of my trip to the Bahamas is eating eggplant and getting sick as a dog. I have yet to eat another bit of eggplant. I know about eggplant. I tried it once. This is how these programs can backfire if they're done wrong. You can say, I know about black people. Or I know about Cubans. And I don't want to mess with them anymore. I tried it once. Once burnt, twice shy. So if you're going to set up a program to try to reduce intergroup conflict, and I dearly urge you to do this, you need to do it much more carefully than simply putting people into a room. Because of the way our heads work when we think about other people. I am done now with the talking head part of this hour. And would love to talk with y'all about your experiences with these kinds of things, programs that you know of and how they have helped or harmed, and see what we can learn together. Yes, sir.
Could you comment on having a group in the church, let's say, of gay and straight people?
Mm-hmm.
And the agenda is dealing with feelings about sexuality in general,
mm-hmm.
homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Would you feel that would be a helpful tactic for helping straight people to see gay people as human beings?
Yes, if you were careful about it. The way I'm just talking here. It, by the way, also might help the gay folks if you were careful about it. But particularly in, I think I need to do this, the saliva example. I'm sorry, folks. But it's particularly, those of you who have heard it before, just shut your ears. But it particularly works with this issue of homosexuality. One of the things that I wish I had done research on is an area called disgust. It's the emotion of disgust. And Paul Rosen has done some fascinating work on this. Got to do fun studies like making chocolate bars shaped like doggy do to see what people's reaction is. Good chocolate, right? see what people's reactions to it would be. But one of the things that Paul Rosen and others have been able to show unequivocally is that disgust is a learned reaction. Now, mothers and fathers have known this because they have little babies that aren't disgusted by hardly anything. Right? Well, they'll play with it, particularly if they made it. It's fun. But disgust is such a powerful emotion that it feels to us, remember like I said earlier in the hour, it feels to us like it must be true that that thing is disgusting. Here's my saliva example. Saliva is a very nice thing. All of us have it in our mouths at this moment. It works for lubrication, makes it easier for me to talk, and it helps some in pre-digesting our food. Well, you're probably fairly well now aware of the volume and texture of saliva that's in your mouth at this moment, because I've been talking to you about it. Now, I want you to imagine spitting that out into a glass. And now I want you to imagine swallowing it again. Oh, what happened to it? Well, not very much. It just went into a glass and came back. But your reaction is, right? Yuck! That's a learned reaction. It doesn't feel like a learned reaction. It feels like a natural reaction. You just ought to be disgusted at that kind of thing. But in fact, if we, let me use another example to show that there are cultural differences. People in the United States carry handkerchiefs around with them, and they will blow their nose. And then they'll put their handkerchief back in their pocket. People in India see that, and they say, "What in the world would you want to keep that for?" And they're disgusted that you take that and put it back in your pocket. So what they would do instead is go outside or go to the side of the road and just blow their nose with their hand by closing one nostril and snorting. Right? At which point we go, "Ugh!" And God, that's disgusting. Now this works, I think, with the issue of homosexuality, because many people feel this sort of "Ugh!" for homosexuals and homosexual actions. And they say that because that reaction feels so natural, those homosexual actions must be wrong. Because it just feels so natural that I'm disgusted about them. Well, there's news, folks. Your disgust of homosexual sexual relations is learned. It is not a natural response. But you feel it almost like, you feel it exactly like it ought to be a natural response. Now, having said that, let me quickly say, this doesn't say anything about arguments in Scripture or any of this other stuff. It just simply kicks the legs out into one argument. And I'm a psychologist, that's all I can do. I don't do Scripture stuff. But it does suggest that one reaction is learned. One of the things that we can do if we get people together and talk with each other is we can find that there are folks who are gay who are in all walks of life and who are all very different from each other and who will disagree with each other very vehemently, both about issues having to do with the gay community and about issues having to do with Scripture. People who do not like folks who are gay will find that many people who are gay will be on their side with regard to a lot of scriptural issues and a lot of issues in the church. So I think if you can get people together under the right circumstances, you're right. This really would work. But you have to be careful. And you can't just sort of say, "Well, let's invite a couple of folks over." Partly because it is unfair to folks to ask them simply to parade about as representatives of their group. And also because unless you're very careful in the way you set it up, people might do with homosexuality the thing I did with eggplant. Right? And say, "Well, see, I had this one discussion. I came away. I'm still disgusted." There. One of the things that you might find is also is that many of the gay people who participate in the discussion might moderate their attitudes about people who are, quote, on the other side of the issue, unquote, that they are. I think it's very easy for people to throw around words like homophobic, and it turns into my favorite phrase from Alexander, I think is his name. He's the Secretary of Education. He's from South Carolina. His phrase is drive by debate to describe some of these things. Right? And that's what often happens. I mean, it gets modeled on the television for us, right? What is the McLaughlin group but drive by debate? You get 30 seconds to come in with a couple of phrases and gun down all your enemies. And you don't actually get to talk much more complexly about it. So I would suggest that, yeah, please do this. But also be very careful and think about these kind of principles if you do it. Yes?
Yeah, I just wondered what you think about socioeconomic bias. That seems to be the one that's the toughest to work with as far as our experience has been. Whether it doesn't be like racially, you know, African-American rich people really don't want to hang out with the poor folks. And then when you're trying to bridge between races,
that's right. Well, there's some interesting things when you begin to talk about how these two interact, like race and socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. Partly because one kind of prejudice can often masquerade as the other. Mm-hmm. So you might, in fact, be prejudiced against African Americans, but only show it when they're poor.
But let's just
and remember, that's like our example of the wheelchairs.
Right, but let's drop that. I'm seriously talking about
real socioeconomic prejudice.
Same race.
Right.
Okay. Like when somebody with just barely rags on walks into your
church, proper
church.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And everybody turns around. Or,
right.
That's right. And looks at them funny.
Right.
Yeah, they do that to me. Well, I think, again, to change that kind of prejudice, the only thing that you can do to change that kind of prejudice is to have programs that do this. By the way, let me comment that the kind of group that I'm talking about, the kind of program I'm talking about that will accomplish these goals does not have to be a group where everybody sits down in a room together and talks. I think one of the best programs for reducing socioeconomic status prejudice is Habitat for Humanity. Because if you look at Habitat for Humanity, people who volunteer for that do all these things. And you haven't asked them to get together to talk about their prejudice against poor people. Because if you did that, they wouldn't come. But they might come to help build a house. So, you know, be a social psychologist yourself. Get a little sneaky. and look at some of the side benefits that you can get from these kinds of programs. Working in shelters does the same kind of thing. But you have to be careful with working in shelters. Because, of course, if it's just us kind people who are helping out those bad people, you can easily not get a lot of these things, and people can maintain their prejudice while they're dipping out the food or while they're helping people. In fact, you need the kind of shelters that the clients of the shelters help to run if you want to reduce the prejudice. And that's, I think, one of the best reasons for trying to set shelters up like that. In addition to all the other benefits you get, which is that you get folks in your shelter who actually know about the homeless life, or who actually know about the situation that the, quote, clients of your shelter use. So I don't want to suggest that it's just these talk therapy groups that solves this. Very often, talk therapy groups hardly ever do this very first one, which is working together to achieve shared goals. In fact, if you look at what happens in some of the discussions over the recent sexuality what's it? I'm not a Lutheran, so I don't know the jargon for the kind of things people are doing now. People don't come to those discussions with a shared goal. Right? They come to those discussions with very different goals. So it's no surprise that they don't ever talk to each other. Instead, they just do this drive-by debate thing. I want you to notice again that all of the things that I have talked about don't involve taking a side on these issues. All I'm doing is describing how prejudice works, describing how our perceptions of others work. You don't like the word prejudice? We can throw that one away. All I'm doing is describing the way these things work and how to get them to work a little bit better. I'm pushing that point now because next week I'm going to do a lot of stuff about social conflict, and I have a feeling I'm going to upset people both on the left and on the right, which will suggest to me I might be doing my job. And this is a wonderful both defense for me, so that you don't send me out on the next boat, and a reason for you to listen more carefully to the kinds of things that I'm talking about, because I do have opinions about these issues, and if you ask me, I'll be glad to share them. But my role now is as a psychologist who's trying to describe how this stuff works. Did that answer? I know I got kind of carried away, but that's standard.
Is there room in the discussion for the person that comes to church who may be noticed, a member of a minority group, or just somebody that's noticed, and either to the extreme, either nobody talks to them or too many people talk to them. Both of those scare the person away.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. In fact, there's some fascinating work to suggest that because we don't want to think that we're prejudiced, we often overcompensate with members of a stigmatized group. So we will often rate them slightly better to convince ourselves that we're not prejudiced. And that happens in instances where it's clear to us that we can't get away with being prejudiced. And then in those situations where we can't get away with being prejudiced without even catching ourselves at it, we go ahead and do it again. Now, I'm not sure I answered your question, but I sort of took off on your one comment about way too many people coming up and wanting to speak to...
Yeah, that was...
And I say, oh my glory to God, we've got a Cuban. You know? Now we can say we're a good church. Being from Florida, I can do that. And it's a nice stigmatized group in Florida that people up here don't have very many opinions about. I can use that group. But I'm not sure I answered all of your questions.
Well, that was the question I had, but it was about all the people. Mm-hmm. Now, we've already kind of discussed why nobody might talk to them.
Right. And I'm not sure that I've got an explanation for why there might be that sort of upwelling of unprejudice. This example is sort of like the Pharisee who walks down the street praying in the open. My temptation is to go back to the individual motivations of each of those 30 people who rush up and talk to them. And somehow I feel like I might be wrong. I feel like there might be something else going on, but I can't put my finger on it right now. Sorry. Yes?
Probably in the church is where we are all sort of primed to be good and take care of these problems.
So oh, yeah. That's a very good point.
Partly that we really, truly think this is appropriate behavior. You know, And I think maybe just sometimes it's helpful for somebody to share in a little paragraph, you know, some little thing written somewhere that isn't really helpful. You know, I'm sure there's some, I'm just in an over conversation, I've got to get this one off my chest, I'll take care of this cute and the sweet, and then I'm worrying, you know. But I think truly we all, I mean, I know myself, so we've got to take care of all the problems and fix everything.
And this is, I think...
We need to work on our own prejudice. We need to clear some things up.
Amen. Amen. And we need to be very, very careful when we think about whether or not we really are prejudiced. That's why I made these suggestions earlier, that it's the level that our dialogue is usually at is not the level that our prejudice is at. And therefore, we need to really rethink what our schemas are like. Another example came up in an earlier group that I'd like to use now, and that is that for people in the Midwest, the level of prejudice, the level at which their prejudice occurs for Orientals, probably is at the level Orientals, because after all, there's just not that very many people of Oriental descent who are in the Midwest, compared to, say, the West Coast. So for folks on the West Coast, if you're wondering about prejudice in your congregation or in yourself, where that prejudice lives probably is not at the level of Orientals, but it may be at some other level, some subset of bad Orientals. Yes, sir.
What studies, experience have you seen from the other side? We're a pretty white Anglo-Saxon church, a Protestant. What about we as an individual going to the Black Baptist church or whatever, and what's their kind of approach to us in light of the gentleman's comment about one coming or the horde coming? Mm-hmm. Is there a similar norm with them? Or whether you're Native American or Cuban or whatever?
Yes, in fact, there are. And in fact, you can get these kinds of effects of prejudice for other groups simply by dividing, if I divided this group up in half and sent you all that half of the room and sent you folks to this half of the room and started to ask you to think about people who sat closer to the entrance versus people who sat further away from the entrance, y'all would come up with reasons why sitting further away from the entrance is good. Y'all would come up with reasons why sitting close to the entrance is good. Right? You would begin to talk about why you're in group or why sitting away is bad.
Or sit closest to the ice cream.
Or the ice cream, that's right. You could, that's right. You know, and you could divide it up anyway. And in fact, we've even done studies where we've rolled dice. And people still show prejudice to folks who happen to roll low instead of roll high.
Everybody likes a winner.
That's right. Everybody likes to be in the group that's winning. So if you're in a group, you're going to call it the winning group. So these kinds of mechanisms that I'm talking about are not ones that are simply what the powerful group has. Now, it is true that the powerful group, after all, has the power to enforce them, whereas the not powerful group doesn't have the power to enforce them. And it is also the case that very often, if you look at interactions where there are power differentials, it's the people on the bottom who know how things work, and the people on the top who are less aware. So, for instance, in the South, when I was young, it's a little less so now. When I was young in the 60s, it was very clear to blacks exactly how they had to act and where they could go and who they had to yes ma'am or yes sir. Whereas it seemed to whites that was just sort of natural to do. But the blacks knew that it was a strategy that they had to learn in order to get along. So yes, the prejudice happens for all of us because we're all, after all, human. I would even submit that it happens with chimpanzees. But some of us have the power to enforce it. Yes?
I was going to say that I believe that the media, magazines, our parents, we internalize these prejudices, and then one thing happens and then it confirms it for us. You know, a situation, I mean, it's so subtle, you don't even think about it. And you've been internalizing, I mean, not being at Holden here and not watching the news, because I've been here for a year, and then you go out, and so you're in this closed community, and then you go out and you don't see the news, and so many times you don't get a chance to read the newspaper, and then you go out and you watch the, CNN, I guess.
CNN,
and you go,
Tom Brokaw.
But I think that a lot of times we don't think we are, but a lot of what we've been told, what we, you know, we've heard from our teachers and so forth, and a lot of times it's not even, it's lies, it's myths.
That's right. That's right. And we have to think carefully about what it is we do with the kind of evidence that we get. So, for instance, if you get disconfirming evidence of a stereotype that you have of some group, and remember, we're all liable for this, because when I say some group, I don't mean women, I mean feminists. Right? So let's talk about this sub-level stereotyping. When you get disconfirming evidence of that, very often what happens is you go, gee, that's odd. Let's go have some ice cream. and that disconfirming evidence immediately just falls out. It's gone. Right? Because you didn't take time to think about it long enough and say to yourself, gosh, that really is disconfirming evidence. And you're saying, gee, isn't that weird? She smiled at me. Feminists don't usually do that. and then you forget it, and it's gone, and you never occurs to you that, in fact, that's disconfirming evidence. But when we get confirming evidence, that puppy fits right in. And we go, yep, see, there's an angry feminist. And we remember that easily, because it fits right in with the kind of stereotype that we have about that kind of person. And our media very much plays into these stereotypes, because after all, nice feminists don't make news. So you don't get to see on the media the ones that disconfirm the stereotype.
Is there any way of knowing where we get our prejudices from primarily? Is it the home? Is it a major influence, our parents?
Yeah, really it is. It's the home. It's certainly possible to learn one after you leave. I wouldn't want to discount that. But we very often get it from our parents. And let's not cast parents in such a bad light. I like my mom and my dad. They are both racists. One more sort of flagrant than the other. And I learned many of my attitudes about blacks from them. But they didn't mean to teach them to me. Right, so they didn't say, ooh, let's make Chucky Huff a racist. You know, that's one of our goals. All they did was react in their standard way and talk about the things that they talked about and that influenced the way I saw the world. And this is the place I really suggest that we work on if we want to change prejudice. Of course, this is also the hardest place to do it. Isn't that surprising?